Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the opening of the 2019 Indiana legislative session, Franciscan Health implements flu restrictions at its region hospitals, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with newly elected House District 15 Representative Chris Chung. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. A rise in influenza cases locally has prompted new visitor restrictions at Franciscan Health hospitals in Lake County. To prevent the spread of the flu, visitor restrictions have been implemented at Franciscan Health Crown Point, Hammond, Dyer, and Munster. Visitor restrictions include no more than two visitors at a time, no children under the age of 16. Visitors to the birthplace will be limited to two adults and siblings at the Crown Point location. Visitors at the NICU will be limited to parents. In addition, other precautions are taken by staff at the hospitals. Any employee unable to receive the flu vaccine must wear a mask. Patients with a cough or other respiratory symptoms must be masked on admission or when leaving their room. Magazines are removed from waiting rooms because of the potential for those items to transmit infections. Though the common cold and the flu can often look alike, symptoms like fever, headache, body aches, weakness, fatigue, and extreme exhaustion are more common indicators of the flu. Also, with the flu, symptoms tend to be worse, come on suddenly, and can last as long as 2 weeks. Individuals can prevent the spread of the flu by avoiding close contact with anyone who is sick and by keeping themselves and their surroundings as germ-free as possible. Wash hands often with soap and water or use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer. Avoid touching your mouth, nose, and eyes, and disinfect any surfaces that can become contaminated. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Legislative leaders of both parties kicked off opening day of the 2019 session on Thursday with messages of bipartisanship. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports it's also clear where some of 2019's dividing lines will be.
The first day of session is traditionally reserved for the House Minority Leader to lay out their caucus's vision for the session, and some of New Democratic Leader Phil Giaquinta's agenda isn't popular on the other side of the aisle. That includes pre-existing health condition protections, redistricting reform, and more money for pre-K education.
We must embark on a bold expansion of the program to give all children across the state access to pre-education.
But Republican floor leader Matt Lehman says there are significant areas Giaquinta cited that will have bipartisan support.
Teacher pay, pushing money down to the teachers, is a priority of ours, as is fixing DCS.
The 2019 session will run through late April. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Republican officials say Governor Eric Holcomb has $4 million in campaign funds, nearly 2 years ahead of his expected re-election bid. The state GOP says Holcomb ended 2018 with more campaign cash in the bank than any previous second-year governor. Holcomb's political operation has even more money available when adding in about $800,000 in Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch's campaign account and the state GOP's some $900,000. Holcomb's fundraising comes as no active Democratic challengers have yet emerged for the 2020 campaign for governor. State records show Holcomb spent $14.8 million on his 2016 campaign, with $7.6 million of that coming from the Republican Governors Association. He defeated Democratic nominee John Gregg, whose campaign spent $16.6 million. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana prosecutors have quietly dropped efforts seeking the execution of an Ohio inmate for her role in killing a 7-year-old girl in 1984, citing the inmate's intellectual disability. The Times reports the Lake County prosecutor and the Indiana Attorney General's office signed an agreement last month withdrawing a demand for the execution of 56-year-old Deborah Denise Brown. Brown and Alton Coleman received death sentences for killing Tamika Turks of Gary and for slayings in Ohio. For more than 50 days, the couple committed crimes across six states, leaving eight people dead. Coleman was executed in Ohio in 2002, while Brown's Ohio sentence was commuted to life in prison on grounds that she was mentally disabled. A spokeswoman for the Indiana Attorney General said U.S. Supreme Court rulings prohibit Brown's execution because of her disability. Brown was ordered to serve 140 years in prison in addition to a sentence of life without parole. She's currently an inmate at the Dayton Correctional Institute in Ohio for two killings in that state. Laverne Turks, Tamika Turks' mother, said she's angry and hurt she wasn't notified about the decision. She said attorney Thomas Vaines, who had won Brown's death sentence conviction in 1986, told the family about the agreement around Thanksgiving Day. Laverne Turks goes on to say, quote, Deborah Brown was right there with Coleman committing the same crimes. Melissa Gustafson, spokeswoman for the Attorney General's office, says she believed the families of the victims had been contacted by the Lake County Prosecutor's Office. She goes on to say, quote, the Office of the Attorney General deeply regrets that they were not notified in advance because we take seriously the dignity of the victims of all crimes and our responsibility to ensure that dignity within the criminal justice system is served.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A Northwest Indiana scrap metal dealer convicted of demolishing a historic railroad bridge and selling the metal is seeking a new trial. Kenneth Morrison's defense attorney says in a motion filed last week that federal prosecutors didn't meet their burden of proving that he illegally scrapped the century-old bridge. The Post-Tribune reports the court filing asked a federal judge to acquit Morrison and order a new trial. The Whiting man was convicted in December of interstate transportation of stolen goods for allegedly demolishing the unused Monon Bridge near downtown Hammond and selling the metal to Illinois scrapyards for $18,000. Morrison's lawyer says prosecutors failed to document whether Hammond had clear ownership of the bridge, but instead relied on statements that Morrison made to a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency about permits.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Environmental Protection Agency has canceled a public hearing on a cleanup plan at the USS Lead Superfund site in East Chicago due to the government shutdown. After a contentious meeting last month, residents asked for a second hearing on the EPA's plans to remediate a portion of the site where the former West Calumet housing complex once stood. Residents said they needed more time to ask the EPA questions and give the agency feedback. Though the meeting next Thursday, January the 10th, has been canceled, the EPA says residents can still comment on the lead and arsenic cleanup through January 14th.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Environmental Protection Agency is reconsidering the reasoning behind its rule that limits air pollutants from coal and oil-fired power plants. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, an expert says that could lead to the standards undoing and more coal pollution in Indiana.
The Obama-era rule's goal was to reduce specific pollutants, such as mercury and nickel, but the EPA expected it would decrease others, too. This new proposal wouldn't consider those, dropping the estimated public health benefits from up to $90 billion to under $6 million. Janet McCabe, who now works for Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute, helped develop the rule under the Obama administration. She says this could set up the rule for a legal challenge and change the way the EPA writes regulations. McCabe says since 2011, the rule has reduced mercury emissions by about 80%.
The rule has made a difference, and certainly this would not be the right direction to go.
Utilities have already spent more than $18 billion to comply with the rule. If it goes away, McCabe says they could decide to scale back or stop running pollution control technology. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's sixth baby box was dedicated in Hamilton County last Friday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports the boxes are designed for mothers to surrender a baby and remain anonymous.
Indiana's safe haven law allows anyone to surrender a newborn in a hospital, police, or fire department without any questions. And special baby boxes give people an additional option. To place a baby in a box that is accessible from the outside of a building, an alarm system notifies staff inside. Monica Kelsey, who was abandoned as an infant, says two babies have been placed in these boxes so far.
Right now, we're being proactive, but we don't want to be reactive. You know, we don't want to find a baby and then have to go into that area. So we want to be in that area, educating the youth, educating every woman that might possibly find herself in this situation.
The organization also staffs a 24-hour hotline to counsel women in crisis pregnancy. The new box is located at a fire station in Carmel. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
U.S. Education Secretary Bessie DeVos recently rolled back Obama-era guidance aimed at preventing schools from disciplining students of color more harshly than their peers. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports it likely won't affect efforts on the issue in the state.
Indiana's General Assembly passed a law last year to move schools away from out-of-school suspensions and limit the use of law enforcement in school discipline. Representative Greg Porter worked on the legislation and calls the federal change dangerous for students of color, but he says Indiana's progress on the issue won't be limited.
We should not, and I don't think we will be discouraged or be sidetracked by the antics that are transpiring at the national level.
Porter says he plans to file a bill this year to ensure another person remains in the room during interrogations between law enforcement and students. He says another focus, improving cultural competency for educators. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Tyler Trent, a former Purdue University student and college football superfan who inspired many with his battle against cancer, died Tuesday. He was 20 years old. His family confirmed the death to the Indianapolis Star. Trent wanted to be a sports writer and was determined to attend Purdue despite suffering three bouts with a rare bone cancer, first diagnosed at age 15. He entered Purdue in the fall of 2017 while undergoing chemotherapy. He camped out with another student to get good seats to a Purdue-Michigan football game just hours after chemotherapy. He gained national attention in 2018 by becoming adopted by the captain of the Boilermakers football team. He was in a wheelchair for Purdue's upset win over Ohio State, which was ranked number 2 in the nation at the time. He became a social media star with his positive attitude and determination to live every day to the fullest despite the illness. Trent earned an associate degree from Purdue in computer information technology. The Purdue Athletic Department offered condolences to Trent's family and friends in a statement posted on its website.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A petition urging Indiana lawmakers to study rising drug prices was delivered to the State House this week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the effort to increase transparency on the issue.
Some states have laws that force drug makers to report on the cause of dramatic drug price increases. An Indiana group that advocates for affordable insulin delivered an online petition to Public Health Committee members this week asking them to consider such a measure. Sarah Skipper was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when she was 5. The cost of insulin climbed in recent years, and Skipper says even with insurance, her prescription costs about $1,000 a month.
Then now, as a working adult, I have to pick and choose. Do I want my insulin, or do I need to pay my bills? Or, you know, so it's hard.
Other drugs have become unaffordable for many people, causing some to ration their medicine. Drug pricing legislation allows states to collect data on generic brands, production costs, and sales to curb price hikes. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Getting the right treatment for a child who has autism can be tough, and parents can run into the same problems for a child who has a mental illness. So imagine what happens when a child has autism and is mentally ill. Side Effects Public Media's Isaiah Seibert has the story of one woman's fight to help her son.
Yvonne Martin keeps detailed notes of 2 years in her life. It starts on March 1st, 2016. That's the day her son, Daniel, first ran away from the family's home near Evansville, Indiana. He was 13. She reads one entry.
Danny's parents called 911 in a state of panic. After several hours, search and rescue is contacted, and there is suspicion that he was in the Ohio River.
It was one of the scariest things she's ever experienced.
No parent wants to hear that we're now going to search for your child in the river because we can't find him.
Danny has autism and a post-traumatic stress disorder. He's what some call a dually diagnosed child. Yvonne's timeline logs the outbursts, calls to police, trips to acute treatment centers, and the talks with state agencies to get care for Danny. But she couldn't find residential treatment for Danny, and he took a major turn for the worse on the evening of July 22nd, 2017.
And I went up to give him something, and he came out of his bedroom, and the first thing he did was he hit me.
She and her husband went outside and called 911.
And the officer went in. I said, he's autistic. Please don't touch him. You don't touch an autistic person.
Despite her pleas, Yvonne says an officer ordered Danny to put his hands behind his back.
He just stood there looking at her. She grabbed him to try to turn him around. And that's when he fought. Then two more cops came into the house. And we heard, stop fighting. We heard one of them yell, he's going for my gun.
She says police threatened to shoot, but eventually subdued Danny and put him in handcuffs. He ended up in a juvenile detention facility for over a year. Yvonne was glad Danny was safe, and he got some therapy and special education services, but she believes it wasn't enough. Looking back, she also wonders if this whole situation could have been avoided if Danny only had found care sooner. Yvonne calls it a game of hot potato. She says every state agency she contacted would say it couldn't help Danny. She'd be told to call someone else. Finding a residential treatment center was a similar story.
That is absolutely an issue where, you know, we see consumers punted back and forth between providers, often on the basis that, you know, they're claiming they're not equipped to handle that individual.
Justin Schrock is a lawyer with Indiana Disability Rights who helped the family seek care. He says state mental health services are often siloed. It makes finding care difficult for people like Danny who need more than one type of service. Yvonne says autism treatment centers wouldn't take him because he's high-functioning, and treatment centers for general mental illness would say they aren't equipped to provide services to children with autism. The state acknowledges that there are gaps in care for people with very specific mental health care needs. A spokesperson says a new facility set to open in Indianapolis later this year has a unit designed for children with autism, which may help fill some of those gaps. Amy DeVries also wants to fill those gaps. She leads Congregations Acting for Justice and Empowerment, and she's heard similar stories from parents of children all across the autism spectrum.
And it's not just residential. We're looking at outpatient services, acute care, which would be, in our case, Deaconess Cross Point. If a neurotypical child is suicidal or homicidal, they would be admitted to Deaconess Cross Point, but that autism diagnosis, 9 times out of 10, gets them excluded.
Deaconess Cross Point is the area's only inpatient acute mental health care center for children. But the chief administrator says it's not a good match for many children with autism. It can be noisy and stressful. Meanwhile, Danny did find treatment. After his parents convinced the state that there was no residential facility here that would help him, they were able to send him to St. Louis, around 150 miles away. Yvonne and her husband have visited. Danny recently turned 16, and Yvonne shows me pictures of his birthday cake.
He got to share it with the other boys he lives with in the cottage. And then what we ended up getting him was a Nintendo Switch.
And most importantly, he has the care he needs. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Industry in East Chicago have gone hand in hand for more than a century. Nowhere is that more evident than in the city's historic planned worker community, Marktown. The neighborhood is sandwiched between a massive steel plant and one of the nation's largest oil refineries, BP. The company for years has been buying homes and buildings in Marktown and clearing them away. Many remaining residents want to leave too, but say BP has been offering them way less than their homes are worth. Michael Puente offers this look at what's happening to a historic neighborhood near the refinery complex.
Ricardo Maldonado offers coffee and pastries to his neighbors. They gather in his dining room last week to discuss their homes and their future in this neighborhood called Marktown, It was built more than a century ago by industrialist Clayton Mark so workers could live near his factory. Marktown's unique Tudor-style English homes are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But let's not over-romanticize this place. Although the rent and home prices are affordable, it can be hard to live here. It's isolated from the rest of the city of East Chicago. No grocery stores, no schools within walking distance. Residents say the worst part is the air quality. That's Olivia Chalwance. She's lived in the neighborhood with her husband Juan and their two children for 7 years. She says in Spanish, who wants to live here near so much contamination, the contamination and the odor? Here, Olivia says she prohibits her children from playing outside because of the pollution. Olivia says she and her neighbors want to move, but BP isn't offering enough money for their homes.
This house, you know, I paid $30,000 and I put $20,000 because I fix it.
This is Ricardo Maldonado, whose house we are in. He bought his home 14 years ago, and he thinks it's worth much more now.
And I don't think it's fair if they offer me 30, you know. I think something fair is around 50 or 60, something like that.
BP has offered, in my opinion, a very unjust an unfair value that goes from $20,000 and in some cases $30,000.
Juan Villarreal is a licensed real estate broker who's representing 26 of the remaining 60 or so homeowners in their dealings with BP. Marktown once had more than 200 homes and duplexes, but many have been torn down over the years and their occupants relocated. Villarreal says some homeowners aren't allowed to talk about their dealings with BP. They often make decisions in the dark.
Sometimes we're given an ultimatum by brokers that represent BP, suggesting that if they didn't take the offer now, which would be on an average of $20,000 to $30,000, that they would be lucky if BP would even offer them half. And so there's a lot of scare tactics.
BP's Director of Media Affairs, Michael Abenhoff, says in a statement that the company has been purchasing property around the refinery for more than 20 years in an effort to create more green space. That means clearing away the historic structures and potentially displacing residents. In his statement, Abenhoff says in all cases, the properties were purchased from willing sellers. Where there were safety hazards, BP had the purchased properties demolished or removed, he says. Abenhoff insists BP always negotiates in good faith. East Chicago City Councilman Robert Garcia, who represents Marktown, thinks otherwise.
BP just don't understand. Them homes might not be worth much, but a lot of those residents and homeowners have their homes paid off, and that's priceless to them.
The company hasn't said why it wants to clear the homes, but local environmental activist Thomas Frank has an idea. He says after the fatal explosion at BP's Texas City refinery in 2005, the company wants a buffer between its facility and residential areas.
They're mitigating against the potential for a blast.
Frank says it will be difficult to find a home anywhere for the amount BP is offering.
Where do you go from Marktown? And you're just not going to find a home that you can buy at $14,000 and not have to pay enormous amount of mortgage.
Marktown homeowner Juan Rivas faces that real possibility.
Si no, ¿para dónde nos vamos a ir?
He says, where are we going? With $20,000, we won't get anything. I'm Michael Puente.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A law that went into effect over the summer made previously closed adoption records available to Hoosiers who were put up for adoption from 1941 to 1993. It gives them the opportunity to access vital information like the names of their birth parents. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, it's taking the state longer than expected to process and release the records.
From the moment you step into Kathleen Anderson's home, it's obvious family means a lot to her. The word is featured prominently on several decorative signs that cover her walls, and there's a large assortment of family photos displayed above the fireplace.
As we sit down in her living room, she shows me a picture of her three children from her daughter's wedding.
I mean, my daughter, she always gets how much she looks like me and sounds like me. My oldest son looks more like his dad.
But when it comes to who Anderson looks like, the picture isn't as clear. Bob and Jane Kelman adopted her at birth in 1968. A framed, worn portrait taken shortly after the adoption shows them dressed up with Anderson in Jane's arms. Anderson says it's their first family picture.
I kind of always like this picture because it really captures to me like the essence of who they were at that point in time. So proud to have me as their daughter.
Anderson says she's grateful for her adoptive family, but she's wondered her entire life about her origins. She has small tidbits of information, including her birth date, the hospital she was born at, and her mother's age, only 16 when she gave birth. Her adoptive parents also told her they agreed to raise her Catholic as a condition of the adoption. But Anderson wants to know more.
I guess I've just always wanted to know, what was my parents' story.
She hopes she could soon find out. A law that went into effect in July opened up previously closed adoption records. It gives Hoosiers put up for adoption during that time access to more information, which could include their birth parents' identities. Birth parents can contact the state if they wish to restrict any identifying information from being released to the child. But Anderson decided to take a chance and file the paperwork anyway. She submitted it to the state shortly after the law took effect in July.
I had expected at the time that I filed that, maybe around Thanksgiving or beginning of December, I would have it. Now I'm thinking it might be more like March or April.
The Indiana State Department of Health is in charge of processing the requests. The agency didn't make anyone available for an interview, but a media relations representative said in an email, the state has received more than 3,300 records requests under the new law. Nearly half of those came within just the first 2 weeks the law went into effect. The department says it's released just over 860 records. We are continually looking at ways to decrease the processing time, including hiring additional staff, because we know this information is very important to those who are seeking it, the email says. Anderson says she's frustrated by the long wait to get her information. Legislators passed the bill in 2016, but waited to put it into effect until 2018. The thinking was that would give the state 2 years to prepare. Anderson says she's not sure why the state didn't allocate additional resources to help, but she's hopeful the process will be worth the wait.
You know, I never thought I'd even get this opportunity. I've waited 50 years. A couple more weeks, months, in the grand scheme of things, isn't that long.
The state says it could take up to 20 weeks to process each record. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
Republican State Senator Randy Head is proposing a bill this year that would address another issue with the adoption records bill. It would make it clear people are entitled to copies of their adoption records rather than just getting the opportunity to inspect or copy the information by hand.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with newly elected House District 15 Representative Chris Chung.
One of the things I know that you're going to concentrate on, among a lot of things, besides getting accustomed to being at the State House for your first legislative session, is to be able to take on the wishes of your constituents. And, of course, one of them, a big group of them, for that matter, is the town of Griffith. Tell us how the town officials asked you to get involved in the issues that have come up here since they can't seem to find a suitable township to be able to join here now.
Yeah, we were just talking together about some of the issues that had come up. I mean, it was a really interesting thing that happened in September of 2018 when the town did vote in a special election with really high turnout to ultimately decide with 98% of the vote to move their town out of a certain township. So it was a really interesting thing politically and election-wise that occurred. And when we had been in discussions with Griffith about how to proceed, we were thinking that they would be accepted by either North or St. John Township ultimately in the end. What happened was that those townships, I think, felt maybe a little too under pressure to get something done by the end of the year, and they ultimately decided against taking action in the near future. So that means that for the foreseeable future, Griffith is going to have to look for a legislative solution, which is how we kind of got to talking and seeing as how I represent a good portion of the town of Griffith.
How did this discussion that you may have had with Rick Reifa, who's the president of the town board and the other members of the town council, tried to figure out what would be the best way to approach this? I guess they just realized that their first major problem that they were dealing with Calumet Township was what they were sending in revenue to the township and was not getting covered and coming back for poor relief expenses.
That's right. Yeah, that was the main impetus for starting the special election and the movement to ultimately secede from Calumet Township. What I did was I just try to make sure that I'm on I'm transparent and accessible when it comes to the town and local government levels. I reached out to other town council members as well in my other towns to discuss some upcoming legislative issues that they may be concerned about, mm-hmm. or to ask what are their priorities. I want us to all be on the same page regardless of party. And one thing I'm doing is that I'm on the local government committee as the ranking minority member. So I think we're going to see some interesting, really important solutions for local government be handled.
Do you think you got on that committee not only a chance to get your feet wet, so to speak, in committee work, but also because the fact that that you represent a district that basically has a lot of major county operations in a way, I guess, because you have, three towns basically within your district? There are portions of at least three.
Yeah. I have Dyer, Schererville, and then portions of St. John and Griffith. So it's quite a number of towns and a lot of interesting functions there that we have to make sure that we're on the same page with the state.
Now, on this issue of trying to come up with a way to help the town of Griffith with their poor relief operations, be able to fund the poor relief operations without having to deal with Calumet Township, did you have to confer with any other state lawmakers, some veterans that maybe have gone through the same type of thing or be familiar with it, to get things together for this measure that'll come up?
So I did talk with the chairman of the local government committee, Denny Zent, who's from a different part of Indiana. The place is escaping me, right? I think it's Angola, Indiana.
That'd be northeast. It's not terribly far from here, but yeah, it's on the other side here.
Yeah. So we did talk a little bit about what's going to be coming up, and we're going to continue those discussions. What I really want to do is make sure that we're, again, super transparent in this process of bill drafting. There are no little, loopholes or anything. It's a really clean bill, I think, that we have drafted, and a really clean, common sense, good government solution that will help the town of Griffith.
Is this going to be one of the measures that get introduced first off as the session gets underway?
We're going to be looking at the pathway, whether it's introducing the bill outright or introducing it as an amendment, because the legislature has this funny rule called the bill pending rule, which means that if you introduce something as a bill, you're not allowed to introduce it or talk about it as an amendment. So you have to really pick and choose your battles carefully, how you want to introduce it.
You think maybe that's a good way to get started, I guess, even if you don't do it yourself, introduce it yourself as the sponsor, that if you're part of the process, a good way to learn things too, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree.
Okay. Now, you gave us a little indication here of what you're hoping to do on this particular bill. What if you can tell us now, what will this look like, at least at introduction, when it comes in and goes into the hopper?
So right now, we've been talking about with the town council since, I should back up a little bit, mm-hmm. with the Department of Local Government Finance, the DLGF, which is the entity downstate that oversees kind of all of the municipal finance level government functions in the state of Indiana throughout the towns. And one thing that we talked about was what would the new government potentially look like, and the best option that we decided on was modeling it after Indianapolis's county council or city county council UNIGOV option. Mm-hmm. So what ultimately we would do is just transfer that option here, translate it to our needs, and the town council and the executive of the town council, the town council president, and the town council itself would be acting as the trustee and board of the township, respectively. We think that's a really common sense solution that doesn't add an unnecessary layer of government that will make the business running the town really smooth. And one thing we've talked about with those folks is that folding in some of the township functions at the town council level is a really doable thing from what we understand from it. Having the boundaries the same will make it a lot easier and reduce administrative redundancies. And it's just a good common sense bill, I think. So that's our option.
DLGF seemed to feel that because there's been this push because of the measures that have been passed in the past to try to reduce the amount of state government, in particular township government, that this was a better option to go with rather than having to be forced into creating your own little township in the town of Griffith and just be one more plug in the hole, so to speak.
So the option we have now is actually creating its own township government. It would just be the same boundaries as the town of Griffith. There have been larger talks with the State Chamber of Commerce and other groups out there who are looking at abolishing township government altogether, which right. is kind of a really bold move that I don't know if we're ready for at the entire state level. If anything, I think it should be left up to local control, kind of a local decision whether or not the township you find is really necessary. I like to use the example that I live in St. John Township, and even though I appreciate and admire the people who run the township government, I wouldn't really notice if it were gone tomorrow. Unlike North Township, which does provide a lot of services with Wicker Park and with the Dial-A-Ride, it's extremely visible in the community, and a lot of people are big fans of that service and paying into it and making sure it's well run. And Frank Mervan has done a fantastic job as trustee, and all of his experience has proven.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.